Okay, can you hear me?
All right,
so Tom says I can stand anywhere I want. I would be inclined to sit on this stool. Is that all right with everyone?
Yeah.
All right, thank you. So the first thing I want to say is I would imagine anybody that knows Tenzie may be disappointed that Tenzie's not here. Well, I share that disappointment. I really wish Tenzie were here, but she can't be. She's with her mom at the hospital. And Tenzie, if you know her, she's spoken to you before, and she just, clarity and grace and wisdom just well up in her, and I enjoy that as much as all of you do. And so she sends her apologies for not being here, and I'm going to muddle through this the best I can without her. So the first thing I want to say is Tom called us and said we're reading this book, and there's a chapter on rebirthing God through nonviolence, and he sent us a copy of the book. And, you know, it's always a question, why are we being asked to do this? I just want to say, and I don't think this is humility, we really aren't experts on nonviolence. We're like the rest of you. We're struggling to try and integrate nonviolence in our lives. And we have the same struggle as anybody else. So I don't know that I have a lot of words of wisdom regarding nonviolence, but I do have a strong belief that nonviolence is important. And I would say that Tenzie and I have struggled for 20 years to incorporate that in our lives. So I will talk about some of our experience, and it's just our opinion, or my opinion. You take it for what it's worth, if that's all right. So when we looked at the book, we were reading it, here's the two things that struck us sort of deeply. One was John Philip Newell runs into this man he has on a pedestal, and this guy is an icon regarding nonviolence, and he's the abbot of the monastery at Iona, and he's always adored this man, and he runs into him, and George, I say George MacLeod, I don't know if it's George MacLeod or George MacLeod, but in any case, he invites the author to his house, and he pours him a whiskey, and they begin a conversation. And he says to John Philip Newell, he says, "Newell, what are we going to do about all this?" That really, really resonated with Tenzie and I, because that's the question. When it comes to nonviolence, our feeling is not a rejection of violence. I mean, it is a rejection of violence, but the point is, what do you do actively when you set out, as Gandhi suggested, to, he said, rejecting untruth is as important as accepting truth. So, you know, we're probably all truth seekers, you know, and when we find the truth that really resonates with us, we accept it, we incorporate it, but it's equally important to resist and reject untruth. And that's the point of nonviolence, is to find a way to do that. And usually, as Gandhi taught us, it's a third way. It's some third way. And I have a story I just want to tell about that in a minute. But just to give you a background, Tenzie and I came to Guadalupe 20 years ago. We opened a Catholic worker house. And Catholic worker houses, they serve the community. And that's what we set out to do. But Catholic worker houses also have a tradition of what we call resistance. So you find the reasons why the people you are serving are in the spot they're in, and then you try and address those reasons. You try and make an intersection with an institution or a system that's causing them to be poor or cast out or marginalized, and you try and do something about that. So you brainstorm, you know, and so when we first came to Guadalupe, it was clear. We're working with field workers. We would go to the strawberry festival, and we'd leaflet and say, you know, like, who's getting rich from strawberries? It's not the workers. The workers are getting nothing. They're living in poverty while you know, growers and distributors and truckers and everybody else involved as a decent living. And we would do stuff like that, and then we'd get people very angry at us because we're raining on their parade. They're trying to have a festival here about how great strawberries are for us, and we're saying, before we congratulate ourselves, what about the people that are bringing it to us? You know, and now I know you know that undocumented immigrants are getting slammed again, which is why I put that on the card. I feel a real sense of gratitude to have been allowed to work with undocumented immigrants now for a long time. So the second thing I want to say is shortly after we got to Guadalupe, we had a television in our house because we have guests, you know, that people that need a place to stay. And one night, my jaw just dropped. I said, Tenzi, come here. On the television was a spot. I guess it wasn't really an ad. It was a spot. It happened to be the 50th anniversary of the beginning of the U.S. Air Force. And I don't know the history. Tom would know the history. But somewhere, the U.S. Air Force became one of the branches of the military. And this was the 50th anniversary. So here was the spot. There were F-16s flying in formation. And there was big billowy clouds. It was almost beautiful, these F-16s flying. And a voiceover, you could hear a voiceover, and it said, I get emotional when I think of this. It said, Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. And I thought, those rascals, you know, it was a sacrilege, I felt. So because we're kind of in the Catholic worker movement, we said, okay, we're going to shift our activism a little bit, and we're going to spend some time out in front of Vandenberg Air Force Base, which we did. And I would say I'll speak for myself, my own attitude changed from a not so nonviolent perspective to a more nonviolent perspective. When I first went to Vandenberg, I considered the people at Vandenberg my enemies. That's not a good place to be. And Gandhi would say, I regard no one as my enemy. And it took me a little bit of time to get to this place where I'm resisting the mission of Vandenberg Air Force Base. I feel passionate about testing of intercontinental ballistic missiles. They're a delivery system for a hideous, hideous weapon that wipes out millions of innocent people indiscriminately, and we think that's okay. And I don't. And so we go out there and we vigil. And we call it a vigil, much like you would have a loved one in hospice and you sit and vigil with them. The expectation is there's going to be an outcome. There's going to be a death. There's going to be a passing on here. And you're quietly vigiling as a witness and a companion to that transformation. That's how we view vigiling at Vandenberg. It's not really a protest. We're called protesters, but in our own minds, we typically wouldn't go out and say, what do you want? Peace. When do you want it? Now. We typically don't do that. We would have a sign to explain why we're there, but we're vigiling. It's more of a quiet, and there's folks in this room that know that and been there and understand that. So in 2003, Tenzi and I had both been to Iraq, and we fell in love with the people in Iraq. They were suffering because we insisted on sanctions that were starving their kids to death, and it was 5,000 kids a month that were dying in Iraq because of our sanctions. And then the build-up to this, you know, invasion of Iraq, and here it goes. The question is rejecting untruth as important as accepting truth? And what are we going to do about all this? That's the underlying foundation for nonviolence. So Tenzi and I, we have a free medical clinic in Guadalupe, so we went to clinic on a Thursday night, and we asked the doctor that was working that night, volunteering her time, would you draw blood out of both of our arms and put it in a bottle? And we did. And the next day we went out to Vandenberg Air Force Base, and it was 5 days before the invasion, and we stood out in the morning and we prayed, Lord, make us an instrument of your peace, to take that back. And we waited till security came out, and then I threw the blood on their wall, and all hell broke loose, and I ended up in prison. So, I'm going to come back to that in a bit. But I just want to give you just a little bit of a background for the beginnings of our understanding of living nonviolence. Part of living nonviolence includes a willingness to suffer. Now, Tenzi was going to talk about this. The example I want to give is recently I spent 4 months in prison. I was in jail. I was in the prison in L.A. From, I think, May till September. I missed the kids' whole summer. They were in school when I went in, and they were back in school when I got out, and it was a really good summer. They had lots of things going on. I missed it all. The kids really missed me. They missed me not being there. Tenzi worked twice as hard. It was a suffering, and I don't want to make that sound more dramatic than it is, but it was a suffering. And in the process, I was writing a column for the Santa Barbara Independent, and when the prison didn't want me doing that, they sent me to the hole, which is where I got Tom's book, which was great. And when I went to the hole, Tenzi and the kids suffered more. They were worried to death. And I know some of you wrote letters to the prison because Tenzi was so worried. You know, you don't know what happens to somebody when they go in the hole. You know, it's a tough deal. And so the prison's response to that was to get very angry at me. And so then they kept me in the hole. They were going to let me out, and then they kept me. And I said, there's nothing I can do. I got people that love me. What am I going to do? They're writing to you because they love me. So in any case, the point I was going to make is that part of nonviolence is this view, what are we going to do about this? What are we actively going to do? Not what are we going to think? What's our ideology? What are we going to talk about? What are we going to do is a big part of nonviolence, and another part is you got to be willing to suffer on some level. You know, Jesus would say, you got to take up your cross and follow me. You know, well, no one's asking us to end up on a cross, but active nonviolence requires some suffering, and Gandhi led a movement where a lot of people suffered, and so did Martin Luther King, and so that's in there. That's part of it, and I think it's important that we say that. The third thing that I wanted to say is, you know, the house that we opened in Guadalupe is called Beatitude House. We call it Beatitude House because we see the Beatitudes is kind of like the operating manual for people who want to be disciples of Jesus. That's kind of the instruction book. There's a Church of the Beatitudes community here in Santa Barbara. The Beatitudes mean a lot. But where do we fit in the Beatitudes when it says, blessed are the poor, for yours is the kingdom of God? I'm not poor, you know. And blessed are those who are mourning, and blessed are those who are hunger and thirst. And, you know, and I'm thinking, where's my place in there? Am I left out of the Beatitudes? Well, there is a Beatitude, blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are the peacemakers because they will be called children of God. And that's not so bad. That's kind of nice. I wouldn't mind being called a child of God, you know, and So the experiment then is, okay, let's set out to be peacemakers. Let's find our place in the Beatitudes. And let's see. Let's see if anybody calls us a child of God. Or let's see if we feel blessed. So that's the experiment. That's what we started out with 20 years ago. I do want to talk about the third way, because that's a huge thing in Gandhi's vision of nonviolence. So nonviolence is not passive, it's active. You know, on one side you have people that are willing to be violent, and that's clearly active. And then you have people who are striving for nonviolence, but that requires just as much activity. The first time I went to prison, I had, you know, they give you a psychological evaluation when you go to prison, because attempted suicide is high in prison, and so they check you out when you come in. And so the psychiatrist came to see me, and she thought I was nuts. I practically chose to be there, you know. I threw blood on a wall, you know, and she wanted to say, but you know, why would you choose prison? And I said, well, I didn't choose prison. The judge chose prison, but I chose to accept it if that was the consequence. And she says, can't you see what you're doing to your wife and your kids? You're separating yourself from you're abandoning your wife and your kids. What kind of a husband and father are you? This is a psychiatrist telling me, what kind of a husband and father are you? And I said, well, I suppose I'm a lot like a husband and father who's over in Iraq right now, fighting a war. They've left their wife or their children, or if a mother might have left her husband and her children, and they're over fighting a war. Why is it crazier to take on the suffering of separation from your loved ones? Why is it crazier to do that for peace than it is to do that for violence? Well, she just shook her head. You know, she was still convinced I was crazy. But it is important. Our idea of a third way in that instance was to do a public demonstration. It drew a lot of attention, and we're still living the consequences of that attention. But it was not violent. It didn't hurt anybody, and it caused an intersection with the movement of the violence. So I want to just tell at least one story from my recent prison experience, because, see, we can study nonviolence, and we can read about it. We can read John Philip Newell's book, and we can get together and talk. And as Tom said at the beginning, it's not always an academic thing, you know, but it is. I mean, we need to find our source that helps us attain what we're trying to attain. But there's a lot of people who have integrated that, the principles of nonviolent, without ever reading anything, without reading Gandhi, without reading John Philip Newell, and we can learn from them as well. There is a quote. I'm not that much of a Bible scholar, but there is a quote where Jesus say is thanking God for giving to the poor and educated what the wise and educated haven't. I don't know. You know which one I'm talking about. So I was in prison, and I had the fortune of being a cellmate with Jeff Dietrich, who's in the Los Angeles Catholic worker community, who also was given 4 months at the same time as me. And by sheer miracle, we found our way into the same cell. That was lovely until I went to the shoe. And then when I got back from the shoe 2 weeks later, then somebody had taken my place. So I was put in a cell with Freddie. So Freddie is 34 years old, and Freddie has been in an institution since he was 17. So he was free until he was 17, and then the second 17 years of his life, he was incarcerated, either in juvenile hall or a county jail or state prison. He has not been out. And now he's in a federal prison, and he sees the light. He sees the light because he's getting close to his release date. And not only is he getting close to his release date, but he's managed to rein in his tendency towards anger enough that he's got 6 months of good time. He's going to get out 6 months sooner than he would have gotten out because he's been able to toe the line. And he's really happy. He's really happy. And we would sit in the cell and he'd say, "Dennis, I just hope I make it. I just hope I make it. I think I can do it this time. I hope I make it." So Freddie, I can't remember what his job was. We all had jobs. But his job, for some reason, wasn't suited to him. And so he asked to have a different job, and they said yes. And so they took him off that job. But at 11 o'clock one night, came one of the lieutenants knocking on his cell door. "Why aren't you at work?" He said, they let me off that job. I'm not on that job anymore." He says, "Well, you're on the job. If I tell you you're on the job, you get up." And Freddie, having gotten woken up out of a sound sleep at 11 o'clock at night, let loose with a string of expletives at the lieutenant through the cell door. And like that, the lieutenant had the guards there, and off Freddie went to the hole. Okay? And then he got I forget what they call it now, but it's the charges. And here were the possible consequences: more time in the hole, loss of all his good time, no more email, no more phone calls, all this stuff. Well, he went to his hearing and he explained the whole thing, and the hearing officer sort of sided with him and said, "Okay, we're not going to give you any consequences, but nothing again. One other thing you do, you're losing all your good time." Is this too drawn out? Are you with me? Can you follow this? Okay, so Freddie gets a job working down in the kitchen where I'm working. We're washing dishes. And we're down there, and the CO, the correctional officer who's in charge down there, Mr. Ho. And Mr. Ho is a little rough around the edges. You know, Mr. Ho, he's a tough one to work for. So he walks up to Freddie, and he tells Freddie, "I want you to go and move those carts." And Freddie says, "Well, that's not my job. My job is dishes." He says, "Your job is to do what I tell you to do." This is kind of a theme in prison. "Your job is to do what I tell you to do." Well, Freddie couldn't help himself, and he dug his heels in. He says, "I'm not doing it." And Ho says, "You're doing it, or you're losing your good time." And Freddie says, "I'm not doing it." And just as Ho was about to drop the gavel, up walks Emmett. Now, Emmett was a short, plump, African-American man who was his first day on the job. He didn't know anybody in the place. But he walks up with a big smile on his face, steps between Ho and Freddie, and says to Mr. Ho, "Why don't you let me move those carts?" And Ho says, "Okay." He says, "Freddie, this is your lucky day." Okay. Now, I'm presenting that as an example of the third way. I'm presenting that as an example of creative nonviolence. And Emmett, God bless him, has never probably even read a book. And so I think to me that kind of addresses not the academic part of nonviolence, but it's where are we coming from? Are we actively looking how to solve a situation? Are we actively looking at what we can do with our bodies, not with just with our thoughts, with our bodies, to resolve a situation? And now is a particularly difficult time for many of us. Maybe not all of us, but for many of us, we feel a little bit disheartened because maybe things in our government aren't going the way we would like them to have gone. It's important not to look at anyone in our government as our enemy. That's number one. Not our enemy. They may be our opponent, but they're not our enemy. And together, if we choose to do that, we can brainstorm on what are ways we can creatively address something if we consider it to be an untruth. And there are plenty of untruths. Just the whole immigration issue is the way it's presented. I didn't see the address to Congress, but I heard a little bit about it. And if those of you that did, if I'm misinterpreting that, tell me. But my understanding is there were some folks there who were family members of someone who had been a victim of crimes by an undocumented person, and our president was pointing them out and holding them up as the reason why we have to be afraid of undocumented immigrants. Am I right? That's so much baloney, you know. It's just wrong. It's a wrong presentation. It's almost evil. And so then the question is, what do we do about that? You know, what can we do? So we do what we do in Guadalupe. We've been doing it for 20 years. We continue. We have to find some more creative things to do. But there's an untruth there, and if we're called to nonviolence, if we're called to rebirth God in that way, then we need to do that. How are we on time? I have a little conclusion. I was just going to tell one other story from prison. Tenzi would have told this story, but she's not here. So, here's another one. That for most of my time in prison, I was on a unit that had 134 men. And there were enough cells so that there were two men in each cell. But mostly during the day, we were out and about in the common area. Well, the day I got back from the SHU, the day I got back to my unit, was also the day of the Democratic National Convention. And it was on the TV. And I didn't watch much TV when I was in prison because mostly I was reading or writing. But to listen to the TV, you have to have a little box, and then you put earplugs in. So the TV's not blaring, which is a real gift. But so you get to hear it if you want, and you don't have to hear it if you don't want. But at the convention, they were just going to have Tim Kaine. Was that the guy, the vice president of choice? He was just going to give a speech, and I knew nothing about him. And I wanted to hear who this guy was. So I went and got my little box, and I put my earplugs in, and I went and sat at the white table. Okay, so the common area has the tables where we sit and eat, and you know the white people have to sit at the white table, the black people at the black table, the Latino people at the Latino people, and the chomos, no matter what race you are, the child molesters, so-called, have their own table, and they can't be in the common area except when they eat. And that's a whole divergent thing, but don't believe that whole chomo thing. So I sat down at the white table and I was listening to Tim Kaine. And next to me was Brandon. Well, Brandon had some mental health issues. I don't know exactly what they were. I was told that he had taken too much drugs or something. Basically, he was well functioning, but he did some odd things, you know, like he would just all of a sudden get up on one of the stools and flap his and make parrot sounds, and he'd do that for like 20 minutes, and then he'd hop down and then he'd go his way. Other times he'd make up a rap, And he'd just walk around doing this rap out loud to nobody, just in his own little world. So everyone kind of knew that Brandon had some issues he was dealing with. But also, Brandon was an excellent poker player. He was an excellent at dominoes. People would invite him to play with them. He had friends. But also, Brandon was a racist, like an overt racist. And he was sitting next to me at the table. Now, I had already had an issue with them before, because before I went to the shoe, do you remember when the police were shot in Dallas? And they made a big thing. Well, Brandon, during that whole thing, unloaded in the common area about, I don't know why black people are always whining and complaining, they're not treated any worse than any of us. And one of the black inmates just couldn't hold it, and he was going after Brandon, and I was, getting ready to run. I wanted no part of it. Well, the whole thing settled down because one of the other black inmates grabbed his friend and said, "This is not worth it." And so that, nothing happened there. But I felt terrible. I thought, I did nothing. I didn't do anything. And yeah, there would have been a real risk to step in. But, like I said, we're all struggling for nonviolence. And I felt like I failed in that thing. So now it's the Democratic National Convention, and Barack Obama comes on to give his address. I'm sitting next to Brandon. The black table's over there, and Brandon lets loose with all his stuff about, I won't even say it, but he's really being really bad at it. And I'm thinking, I'm not going to have to live with that again in myself. It's the second time, I'm not going to do that. But I didn't know what to do. And I present this really, truly as a feeling of the Spirit moving, because I don't know where the thought came from. But he was so loud, I couldn't even hear, even with my earbuds in. So I got up, and I walked over, and here's the black table, and I just stood here and looked at him. And he shut up. He just shut up. And I just stood there, and I continue to watch Barack Obama, and pretty soon I feel this tap on my shoulder. And it's one of the men at the black table getting up and say, "Here, take my seat." And he let me sit at his table. And you know what? That's a big no-no. That's a big no-no. But not one person on the entire floor had anything to say about that. And I will say, the guy sitting next to me at the black table gives me the knuckle. He says, "Welcome back." Now, this was a guy I'd never met or talked to, but he knew that I had come back from the shoe that day. And he said, "Welcome back." I just present that as an experience that I was oh so grateful for, because I found a little bit of a third way. I didn't have to shout at Brandon. I didn't have to shout at anybody. But it came in, and I did it, and something happened there, So I think that's enough of stories. And I have a conclusion, and I'm gonna read it because that's what I do. I don't like to read a talk, but I do like to have a thought that's put together coherently, but it's hard for me to keep it in my head. So I'll just read this little, and then we can do whatever you want. If you want to have some brainstorming or talk or whatever you want to do. Okay. This is what I wrote. "The rebirthing of God is a challenge for us and how we live our lives, not something we're waiting for God to do." So we're not waiting for God to be rebirthed. It's a challenge for us to rebirth God in the world. One of our favorite songs where I live, when we do liturgy, is a song called "The Summons." Does anybody know this song, "The Summons"? Well, Tenzi reminded me that was written by the Iona community. It's a beautiful song. I'm going to just read the first verse. I'm not going to sing it. I want everybody like heading for the doors. But I will read the words. It says, "Will you come and follow me if I but call your name? Will you go where you don't know and never be the same? Will you let my love be shown? Will you let my name be known? Will you let my life be grown in you and you in me?" Okay? So it's a beautiful song, and the other verses are equally as beautiful. The rebirthing of God reminds us that we are called to be that birth. We are called to be peacemakers and the incarnation of the nonviolence of God. We are the incarnation of the nonviolence of God. God is calling my name, and God is calling your name. God's calling all of our names. If we decide to follow, we will have to take up our cross. That's part of the deal. But we will be called children of God, and we will be blessed. And we did the experiment, and we're still in the experiment, and my witness to you is it's true. It's true. You will be blessed.
What would you think of 10 minutes for us to talk to each other in small groups before lunch? How about that? Take 10 minutes just now and form up in little dyads and triads, as they say. Oh, let's see. Yeah, Dennis, there's a request for you. And then we'll come back for questions, too. Okay. But the safety pin you're wearing, what's that about?
Okay, well, actually, my brother who lives in Florida, he lives in South Carolina now, told me about this. And I thought, oh, this is a good idea. I like this idea. So my brother, I won't go into the whole story, but the safety pin represents safety. And when I wear the safety pin, it's just an expression for anybody that understands that you're safe with me. Okay? And it's a response to our current administration. Okay? If you're undocumented and you're scared, you're safe with me. If you're gay, you're safe with me. If you're a person of color and you're scared, you're safe with me. It's just a little notice. And I am surprised, because when my brother told me about that, I thought, oh, that's a good idea. He was wearing one. He came out to visit. And then a woman in Guadalupe came to our food program, and she was wearing this. It's a gold safety pin. I said, that's beautiful. Why are you wearing that? Oh, I don't know. My daughter gave it to me, and I thought it might be useful sometime, so I just stuck it on my sweater. And I said, oh, okay, well, you know, my brother wears a safety pin, and I'll tell you why. And I explained to her. So she took off, and she gave me, would you wear this one? I said, I would love to wear this one. So I'm wearing this, and I am shocked. I'm not surprised that people ask, why are you wearing a safety pin? But I am shocked at how many people come up and just say, thank you so much for wearing that safety pin. You know, and I don't even know why, but there are people that are thanking me for that.
Yeah. I've also found that it's a good reminder to me.
Yes.
To be that safe place.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Can you wear any safety pin, or do you have to have a gold one?
No, I have a gold one because the woman that gave it to me had a gold one. No, you can wear any safety pin.
Okay.
Maybe we should just do questions now.
We can. Whatever you want.
I'd like to mention, just to help, you know, recollection here, that we had marches in the streets of Santa Barbara, the likes of which I've never seen again, when there was the build-up to the Iraq War. I didn't realize that you were spilling your blood at the same time.
Yeah.
But do you recall those in Arlington West and all that?
I sure do. There was so much activism around that I really thought it would have an effect. I was naive. But it did not. have the effect that I thought it would. At one point, I think I read there were 15 million people out somewhere in the world on the one day, the Saturday, the day after we did this action at Vandenberg. And I thought, 15 million people, that's got to have some effect. But it didn't. And we are living the consequences of that very bad decision. There's no doubt about that. And the consequences we're living were all predicted. It's just like global warming. You know, the science saying this is what's going to happen. And now we're living it, and they were exactly right. And we're living exactly what everybody was saying back then. So, yeah. You know, just real quickly, we had something very similar here the day after the the inauguration,
yeah,
with the Women's March. I was blown away. We went to San Luis Obispo. There were 10,000 people out on the street in San Luis Obispo. I was so heartened by that. There's a lot still to be done, but it always makes me happy when I see someone go out of their house and do something publicly.
You'll be thrilled to know that Iraq is being considered to be removed from the 7 countries because we've been there for 15 years, and so we are already doing super vetting.
No comment.
Why doesn't Fred want to move the crate?
Fred doesn't want to move the crates because it's not his job. Okay? Is that a right stance? Probably not. You know, it's a matter, it was, for Fred, it was a matter of integrity. You know, it was, and unfortunately for Mr. Ho, it was a matter of integrity, and neither of them were going to back down. Fred, I would say, I can say this because you'll never meet Freddie. He was not the sharpest tool in the shed. You know, he spent the last 17 years incarcerated because he didn't have all the tools to work with, and he was still struggling with that. God bless him. And so, yeah, for anybody else, it would have been, yeah, I'll do that. I won't wash dishes. I'll do that. But he felt like he was being singled out, and he was. He was being singled out. And a part of me said, would have said, you know, when you disrespect me and I accept that, then I do you as much harm as I do myself. There's a perspective about that. But that I don't think that was so much Freddie's perspective. He didn't want to be told what to do.
I would just like to ask you if you would speak a little bit about living and working among the undocumented people in your community and what the impact has been with this administration. The fears of the people, is there anybody coming to their aid? Are there any raids? What is happening up in Guadalupe?
Okay. Yeah. Well, we've been there long enough to where we have a pretty deep personal relationship with most of the people who we serve. You know, I don't even like to say we serve people anymore. We're all kind of in it together at this point. And especially Tenzi, because most of the people that come to our house are women. And they love Tenzi dearly. And Tenzi has accompanied these women on about everything you can imagine, but there is a great deal of fear right now, a great deal of fear, you know, and people know that our house is a safe place to come to. We never have been connected with any institutions. No one's going to say, okay, now you can't serve the people you're serving. We have no strings attached to what we do. That's a benefit. But we're brainstorming. You know, we're helping people who fear they may be deported for one reason or another make preparations for that. Some women are
writing out their intentions and having it notarized. So if I don't show up to get my kids from school, Maria has my consent to pick up my kids from school, those kinds of things, which is really hard to have to imagine somebody worrying about those things, but they do. We're offering our address. So because there's been some progress in California to treat undocumented immigrants humanly, you know, in a human way, a lot of undocumented immigrants are now in the system. So, for instance, if you were hurt on the job and workers' comp took care of you, as it should, now the government knows where you live. Or if you had a disability, or if you in California, you can now get a driver's license if you're undocumented. But now the government knows where you live. There's people afraid now, because before, when they were anonymous, they didn't work. But now they're afraid. So we're offering for people to any entity that they're concerned about finding them to just send in a change of address and use our address. And we'll keep any mail that comes, and you can pick it up when you come. And so now anybody they would be afraid would come looking for them would come to our house instead of their house. And, you know, so this is like we're thinking of creative ways to try and do that, you know, and it's not easy but to answer your question, there have been no raids in Guadalupe. We haven't had even one report of someone being rounded up or deported yet, so we feel good about that. It is an agricultural community, and it's certain that the agricultural community who have had big sway over government policy is working hard not to have their labor force deported. So that's on the side of the folks that we're with, too.
Why don't we take our break, and then we'll resume the questions and answers.